one of the objectives in studying the Megillah is to try and understand the mentality, the psychology of the wicked people on the one hand. It's a study in contrast, how the wicked people live their lives as opposed to the Torah's idea of the tzaddik, of the righteous individual. With that in mind, we do see a similarity between the behavior of Ahasuerus, and that is the behavior that leads to failure, and the behavior of Haman. Let's take, for example, the case we've been studying, the party. At the party, so Ahasuerus has a desire for Vashti to appear. As we said, that was part of the idea of the party, was to show off, to gain the envy, the admiration of others. We said that's really the objective that most people have. Most people who pursue lavishness and wealth, there's just a limited amount that you can actually enjoy yourself. And people who pursue that lifestyle, it's essentially for the sake of others. It may sound funny to mention it that way, but there are very few people that pursue wealth, extensive wealth, and lavishness for themselves. That's part of the problem. That's part of the misery that these people experience. It's virtually impossible to enjoy it by yourself. Because how much enjoyment can you get out of a huge mansion with 100 rooms and endless luxuries? There's no way that you can use it. So then you have a problem. What are you going to do with it? Well, then the point is to bring people to see it, to have parties, and to show it off. So when a person gets involved in the pursuit of wealth and lavishness, it's essentially always for the sake of showing it off. And generally, the people who are invited, the ones who are their friends, are perhaps more fortunate. They get to enjoy it. People who have wealthy friends who are generous, the wealthy people are generous and then constantly invite them, in a sense, it sounds strange and funny, but those people are in a better situation than the ones that have the wealth themselves, because the ones that have the wealth themselves have all kinds of problems, all the difficulties that come with it, and really they can't just luxuriate and enjoy it that much. So they have to invite others. That's basically what led to this setback of Ahasuerus. I wouldn't say downfall, because he wasn't destroyed by the death of Vashti. They were able to find a way out of it. Didn't have the same impact, obviously. When you talk about downfall, the downfall of Haman, but it was something that was a serious mistake. The question is, why did he do it? Why did he act in a self-destructive manner? So, part of the objective in terms of showing off all of his acquisitions, as we said, the ultimate acquisition is the beautiful woman. And that was Vashti. Vashti was the beautiful woman. It's also interesting to note that, well, we don't have all the information here in terms of their relationships. But in general, when you study the relationships of famous people, wealthy people, the so-called beautiful people, so they try to present the image that they really love each other. One could safely assume that when Ahasuerus wooed Vashti, he probably told her that he loved her. But you see that it's not really the case. She's just a means to his gratification. At this point in time, it was essential for him to exhibit her to others. And when she refused, because this was an affront to her dignity, and he had a choice. What's more important to him, his love of Vashti, or his own ego, his own desire for gratification? Let's see what happens. Which wins out? So the Torah, the Megillah describes the way, the manner in which he acted. What was it that caused him to make this decision? And it was the wrong decision. We know that it was the wrong decision, because He later on regretted it. Okay, so they tried to deal with the situation. They tried to find some compensation, and he winds up marrying Esther, but it was the wrong decision. The fact that they were able to find a substitute doesn't in any way change that. So what caused them to make such a bad decision? Take a look at Pasuk Yud Beis, that's 12, in chapter 1. It says that the queen Vashti refused to come at the command of the king, and Vayitzof HaMelech Ma'od, the king got exceedingly angry, Vachamaso Bo'ara Bo, and his anger seethed within him. So it's describing a state of extreme anger. So what should he have done? How will anybody can get angry. The fact that a person gets angry doesn't necessarily reflect on his being a wicked person. Even though, as the Rambam says, it's interesting to note, the Rambam points out that a perfected individual should never get angry. Hardly ever get angry. He says there's nothing in the world that's worth getting angry about. It does say that it's permitted to display anger, to act as though you're angry when you're dealing with children and they're stubborn and they need a certain display of anger. So there are situations that call for a display of anger, maybe in certain situations also, in dealing with adults that are really essentially children in a different form. So they too sometimes need a display of anger. That's all right, but within you, and you, inwardly, you shouldn't be angry. The problem with regard to Ahasuerus was not so much that he got angry. That's a different question. Of course, a perfected individual doesn't get angry over these types of things. It's what happens after he gets angry. What he did, and what should he have done? All right, so we see the next thing he did was, he didn't act on the basis of his own feelings, but he consulted with experts, Hakarav Elov, those who were closest to him. Then it mentions them. Karshina, Shesar, Admasa, Sarshish, Meres, Marsina, Mamucha. Not clear why we have to know the names of these individuals. These were seven ministers. Roe Pnei HaMelech, those are the ones who saw the face of the king. That means that they were very close to him. And they sat at the front. So these are the highest ministers of the land. Kedas Malasos, to find out what to do with the queen Vashti, in that she had not fulfilled the word of the king. She had disobeyed the king, which was given over into the hands of the ministers. Okay, so far so good. That would seem to make sense, to confer with your advisors. Then it says Vayomer Memuchan, the last one to be mentioned, Memuchan. It's interesting to note that the rabbis say that he was really Haman, and his name was changed when he was elevated. But the person who gives this advice is Haman. Memuchan gives the advice before the king and the ministers. Lo al haMelech levado afsa Vashti haMalka. The queen did not transgress, did not sin just against the king, but rather against all of the ministers, governors, and all the nations that are in all of the provinces of the king. So it's interesting, he's not seeking to defend her in any way. To the contrary, he's trying to do make it appear that the crime is really very serious. But what exactly did she do that was so bad regarding all the others? So the next pasuk, Ki yetzei dvar hamalka al kol hanashim, that when the word gets out, what the queen did to all the women, lahavzos baleihen b'yeinehem, to embarrass their husbands to their very eyes. Biamram, in that they'll say, HaMelech HaChashverosh Amar, Lahavi Esvashti Amalka Lafana Vilova. That they'll cite the example that the king summoned Achashverosh Vashti to come before him and she didn't come. And at this day, the ministers of Paras and Madai, who will hear the word of the queen, to all of the ministers of the king, and there'll be a tremendous amount of degradation, humiliation, and anger. This is the charge that he launches against her. The question arises, was Mamuchan correct? That this is something that had to be done, or else it would cause this problem? Which seems to be some type of a change in the order of things. A certain subservience, it would seem, that the women had towards their husbands, and once they heard this, they would no longer be that subservient to their husbands. In a general way, what he seems to be saying is that this is going to be a serious blow to your authority. People are not going to take you seriously. It doesn't mean that he's only concerned with the status of men and women in the household. That from this point on, women are going to be less subservient. I think it's an illustration of the fact that you have to maintain your authority. Obviously, we're not talking here about a democracy. And the objective is not to encourage independence and free expression. He wanted to maintain the system, the order that had been established. And this would constitute a breakdown. So it doesn't have to be just a question of one area. Generally speaking, one affects the other. When you have a huge empire made up of different kinds of peoples and different groups and hierarchies, in order for it to function smoothly, the laws that govern the fear, that element of fear and respect and knowing your place and so on, they have to be guarded. So what he seems to be telling him is that the word is going to get out. And when the word gets out, people are going to see that the king's authority can be flaunted. Now, first and foremost, it's going to have an impact upon the women. He doesn't go beyond that. But that argument can be seen as having a greater significance. That's where it starts. It starts in the home. There's a lot of truth to that. It starts in the home. Now, if a given order of subservience can be overturned in that way, so that's a serious breach. That's a very significant breach in the entire power and authority of the king. That's the case that he's making. Now, whether that's true or not, whether that's actually going to happen, or whether that was the desire of Mamuchan, because if indeed, according to Chazal, he was Haman, and he was someone who was seeking power, and he wanted the elimination of Vashti, and he was using this as some kind of an excuse because he saw it as an obstacle, that's not easy for us to say. How serious was Vashti's refusal? How much damage would it have caused? It's very difficult in retrospect to see that, because we're not there. We don't know all the various factors. My guess would be that this was an exaggeration. In that we do know that Vashti was not acting this way out of rebelliousness. Rather, he was humiliating. It was a humiliating thing. She was being treated in that kind of a way. And therefore, if that's the case, after he got over his insult and after he got over his drunkenness, had he thought it over soberly, he would have realized that it could have been overlooked. The matter could have been hushed up. Indeed, he could have instructed everybody that knew about it not to say a word about it and play it down. So it seems to me that the advice of Mamuchan was based upon a distortion. Perhaps he had ambitions, and that's why he gave such advice. You see that they went ahead and they made an example out of it. Imel HaMelech Tov. The advice was to issue an edict and have it written as a some type of a law that Vashti refused to obey the king, and she lost her position. She was removed as being queen and substituted by somebody else. V'chol anashim yitnu yakar levaleihen migadol yakatan. And once the word is spread throughout the kingdom, then all the women will give the proper respect to their husbands. And then it says, "Vayitav adav b'yenei hamelach v'asarim." They like the idea. Vayas hamelach kedvar memuchan. Then it says in 22, "Vayishlach svarim al talmidinos hamelach." Then they sent out letters to all the provinces, each one according to its own language. It had many different peoples and nations under them. Leos kalush sore abeveso, that every man should rule in his house. Umadaber kilshon amo, and speak his own native language. Rashi says on the latter that he coerced his wife to learn his language. Since you have a kingdom which encompasses many people, so there are marriages going to take place between men and women from two different cultures or two different languages. So then the question is, what principle is to be followed? Should we be bilingual education? Do we defer to the language of the wife? And so forth. So the answer must be an important issue. That is to say that she has to learn his language. We can reconstruct, it would seem, that prior to this edict, there was more of an element of freedom and democracy in their relationship. For example, there was no law that said that she had to learn his language. So, the objective of the edict was to establish the man as being superior in the relationship, and the woman is being subservient. To the extent that she had to give up her language and learn his language. It's still not clear, though, whether that advice was because that was really necessary or simply because he had a personal objective, and that was to get rid of the queen in order to pave the way for his own rise to power. However, what about Ahasuerus? Ahasuerus agreed. It said that the idea was good in his own eyes. He agreed, essentially, to have his own wife killed. But then it says, in the next verse, in the chapter 2, verse 1, after this event, when the king sobered up and his anger died down, must have been a tremendous anger. It took a while for the anger to die down. Zachar es Vashti, v'yeis asher asasa. He remembered Vashti and what she did, v'yeis asher nigzer aleha, and that which was decreed upon her. So he reviewed the entire thing, the crime and the punishment, from a totally different standpoint, from the standpoint of one who's looking at it without anger. And obviously he was upset, because the next thing we read about is that the Nare HaMelech, that is his assistants, his ministers, he said, "Let us search for our beautiful women and have a pageant and discover a new queen." So that initiates the search for the new queen, and that's the way in which Esther was chosen. But what do you see from this? What was his mistake? Rashi says he remembered Vashti, meaning as Yafya, her beauty, the Natsav, and he became depressed. There was a combination. The combination of anger and wine is a very bad combination. Either one of them is a killer. And the two together is extremely destructive. All right, he got angry, and a person has to know when they're in a state of anger, they're in a state of insanity, absolute irrationality. And it's one thing, I mean, sometimes a person cannot control it. Depending on the extent of a person's perfection. The more perfected a person is, the more they are under control, the less they're apt to get angry, and certainly they don't get angry over trivial things. because they're able to have a certain perspective when they look at things. However, if a person gets angry, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to do stupid things, but a person should be aware of the fact that right now I'm angry. It's one thing for a person to get crazy. That's one thing. But at least the person has the capacity to recognize when they are crazy. And that what they think at that time... See, the danger is that a person can be in this most insane and crazy state, and they lose all regard. They don't care. All restraints are removed. And they allow the sense of anger to dictate their behavior. You see, terrible, terrible things can happen. People can abuse, can fight, can kill, they can do whatever, because they're so absolutely caught up in that emotion of the moment that this is what has to be, and they don't care. They don't care. And that is the danger of anger, especially when you have the element of drunkenness. That's the same thing. Because drunkenness removes certain natural inhibitions. The reason why people like to get drunk, that's the reason, is because everybody's struggling, so to speak, under a certain amount of repression, inhibition. And everybody senses that this prevents them from having more fun. That is, the times in which you have the most fun is when you can be yourself, when you really let loose. But it's difficult for people. Not everybody has the same ability to let loose, because that's a separate thing. Some people are more inhibited, and some people are less inhibited, less restrained. Therefore, when you get together and there's a party, there's always going to be a certain amount of drinking and wine, which I maintain is not necessarily not a bad thing. Serve within moderation. There's nothing wrong with wine in moderation. It's an icebreaker, relaxes you to a certain extent, and encourages friendship and conversation, as long as you don't abuse it. If it's used in moderation to ease... Oh, the danger, of course, of alcohol, though, is it reaches a point where it brings out a lot of emotions and ideas and attitudes that a person normally keeps repressed for good reason. But once the inhibitions are removed, so it creates a certain sense. The person has a certain absolute conviction about how he feels about certain things. And that's when it becomes dangerous. But if a person allows their judgment to be clouded by that state, then they're going to say things and do things that they're going to regret later on. Because these are things that they would reject in their normal waking state. So, therefore, it's very important for a person to be able to recognize when they're in a crazy state. That's extremely important. If a person has that ability, and that's something you could do, because you could argue, well, I'm in that state, so of course I don't recognize it, because I think that this is real, that this is the way it is. No. A person should have the ability to recognize that I've had too many drinks and I shouldn't be driving now, instead of insisting that I can drive. A person may feel, under that influence, under the influence of alcohol, a person sometimes feels that they can do anything, because it inflates their sense of narcissism, their sense of greatness. I can do anything. Don't tell me I can't drive. That's how a person might feel. But an intelligent individual who may get into a state of drunkenness will know already that they're in that state of drunkenness and don't listen to anything I say. Whatever I say now is crazy. And the same is true with anger. That an intelligent person will recognize that right now they're in a crazy state and they'll just put their hand over their mouth. They won't say anything. No matter how strong the temptation, because they have that knowledge that whatever they say is crazy. In spite of the feeling, and under the influence of that emotion, that you're not in the appropriate state, and that you need to wait to postpone it, if at all possible. Well, life doesn't always provide you with those luxuries. Sometimes you have no choice and you have to do something, you have to act, you have to make a decision. So, of course, you seek the most objectivity. Then you bring in objective people. It's not clear whether he brought in objective people. It's not clear whether these advisors were actually serving him well. Or maybe, well, it was Mamuchan. Mamuchan had this idea, and if it's Haman, so we know that Haman was operating with an agenda. He was in search of power. He wanted to amass greater power to himself. Now, what is the downfall of Haman? The downfall of Haman is very, very similar. This occurs in chapter 4. I'm sorry, in chapter 5. After Esther agrees to Mordechai that she must intercede with the king. Of course, she waits 3 days, but she has this plan with the parties. And she invites Haman and Ahasuerus to a party that she makes just for them. And she plays a very coy game. She clearly arouses the... She knew how to utilize the emotions, how to arouse the curiosity of Ahasuerus. That's a very strong one. She displays a brilliance in manipulating people for the correct purpose, of course, to save the Jews. But she really knows how to utilize the emotional weaknesses. Suspense. She's really doing an umbra on Ahasuerus. She's planting seeds. And she has tremendous restraint in that you would think that after achieving the audience with him, and then he agrees to come to the party, and then his curiosity has really piqued tremendously, and what is your desire? What's the point? What do you want? And he's willing to give her anything. It would seem like that's a good time to make your request, but she doesn't do that. She has the ability, the capacity to control herself and to postpone until the following night, which is very risky because who knows what could happen. Good things happen, but you don't know that. But it's very interesting. It's not only Ahasuerus that it has an effect on. It has a very profound effect on somebody else. On Haman. On the surface, it would seem that Haman, if Emma was a great knight, he feels very, very great. This seems to be some type of a pinnacle for him. Let's see what the Megillah says. Vayetze Haman Bayomahu. That's in chapter 5, verse 9. Haman left. He leaves the party on that day. Sameach v'tov lev. Tov lev. Ketov lev ha-melech bayayin. It's the same expression. Good feeling. He's in a high. He's rejoicing. This is the happiness of the Russia, of the wicked person. Let's see how long it lasts. It's a very short duration. See, people who are living according to the false philosophy of life, the false lifestyle, they do experience momentary highs, but their happiness, their moments of happiness are of extremely short duration. Then what happens next? Something very strange. V'cheros Haman is Mordechai b'shar ha-melech. And when Haman saw Mordechai in the gate yard of the king, below Kambalos, I mean, when he didn't rise and he didn't even move. It's interesting, the exact description. Not only didn't he rise, which would have been sufficient, but it mentions below Zah. He didn't even move. Vayimalei Haman al Mordechai Chema. And Haman was filled with burning anger against Mordechai. Let's analyze this. What is difficult? What is strange? Aside from the fact that it has to mention that Mordechai didn't even move, we'll explain that. But there's something very strange about this. The question is, what caused them to get angry at Mordechai now, at this point in time? What had occurred that was new, that hadn't occurred before? This is not the first time that this has happened. He had been apprised that Mordechai refused to bow down. We read about this before. And when he found out about it, he took action. And it describes that Vayivez Bienov, it was too petty to just deal with Mordechai. He found out that he was from the Jewish nation, and he recognized that it wasn't just him, it was part of a whole system, a whole people, and he had to eradicate them, and he was very brilliant in presenting the plan to Ahasuerus to make it seem that the Jews were traitors. And he was successful, and everything was worked out. So why did he suddenly get filled with anger when he saw him? He knew nothing new. This has been happening before. We have to assume this happened pretty much every day. Whenever he passed by, he would see him. So why did he suddenly get angry? That's the question. The Megillah does describe the very first time that Haman saw for himself the strange behavior of Mordechai. That's in chapter 3, verse 5. It says that Haman saw that Mordechai did not kneel or bow to him, and Haman was filled with anger. He was filled with anger. That was an affront to his sense of greatness. But then he was able to overcome the anger because he put together an intelligent plan, of course, for evil aims, but the plan was rational, made sense, in that he recognized that he was part of the nation and he wanted to get rid of the nation. Lahashmid, a plan of genocide. But the brilliance was his ability to sell it to Achashverosh and to make it appear that it wasn't a selfish thing. I mean, he couldn't go to the king and say, wipe out all people over here because this person won't show honor to me. No, he accused the Jews of being disloyal, of being a fifth column, of being dangerous, very similar to Paro. It can't be trusted. Let's get rid of them. And they agreed. Then they would see that he was okay with it. I don't imagine that after that, every time he went by Mordechai, he'd get filled with anger. It doesn't seem to make sense at all. Because there's no problem. There's no need to deal with him. That night, by the way, was a mistake. In order to go to the king, aside from the fact that how it turned out, that he was walking into some kind of a big problem, a big trap, so to speak. But there was no need for him to seek separate action against Mordechai individually. He had never made a case of Mordechai individually. He glossed it over. He was very good at that. Just like, according to Chazal, saying that he was Haman, he never made a specific case against Vashti individually. It was a bigger thing. It was an issue of policy. It was harmful for the interest of the king, the general interest of the king. Here too, he never said anything about Mordechai didn't bow down to me. That would be petty. That would be absurd. He couldn't do that. So he was able to take something which indeed was a personal grievance and to convert it into something which was national policy and thus sell it to the king. So what he was advised to do that night, to go to the king and to make a specific request that Mordechai be hanged, would seem to be something which wasn't a good move. Because to the extent that he was going to do that, he was going to make it into a personal grudge. And there was no need to do it because the date was set for Adar, for 14th of Adar, all the Jews would be destroyed and Mordechai would be destroyed with them. And that's it. And he seemed to be somebody who could control himself. So what happened on that night? Why did he suddenly get filled with anger? To the contrary, this was a great night for him. Things were going perfectly. He never anticipated this. Now, the queen had invited him to this party that she had made just for Achashverosh and Haman, and seems to be the greatest night of his life. So why should it bother him now? We continue our study of the Megillah. And today, we're going to take up an interesting issue. We all know that the reaction of Mordechai. What's so significant, by the way, about the reaction of Mordechai? When Mordechai discovers about the plan of Haman, it became known to him. He discovered the plan. And the Megillah describes his reaction. That's in chapter 4, the first verse. U'Mordechai yada es kol asher nasa. And Mordechai knew everything that had taken place. Vayikra Mordechai es begada. And Mordechai rent his garments. Vayilbash sak v'efe. And he donned garments of sackcloth and ashes. Vayese v'socha ir, and he went out in the middle of the city. Vayizak za'aka gedola umara, and screamed a loud and bitter wail. Was Mordechai the only person that knew about it? Did he have some secret way of finding out about it? And what does it mean that he knew kol asher nasa, everything that was done? As opposed to what? So the pasuk before, at the end of the last chapter, after it describes that the messengers had gone forth in a hurry, under the pressure of the decree to all of the provinces, to tell them about the decree to kill the Jews. It ends in a very interesting manner. That pasuk itself, the last one of chapter 3. In fact, the tune changes when you read it. At certain verses in the Megillah, you deviate from the ordinary trop, the cantillation, the tune that you read the Megillah in. The Megillah is not read in the tune of a dirge. It's not. It's pretty much an upbeat kind of a tune, insofar as the laning goes in general. But there are certain verses where you switch gears and change the tune to the one that's designated for Echa, which is Lamentations. I'll illustrate that, how that's done, the change in tune, in that verse, the last verse of chapter 3. Haratzim yotzu d'chufim bidvar ha-melech v'yados nitna b'shushan ha-birah v'ha-melech v'yaman yashvu l'shtos. So that last sentence, the is a change. It's a whole different mood. And it's sung to the tune of Lamentations. What is the idea of the juxtaposition? Seemingly it's two different facts. Of course they're interconnected. But the first part of the pasuk is trying to tell you that the decree was sent forth, was promulgated. So the danger was there. And then it tells you the reaction of the king and Haman. Well, so what's that have to do with it? What do I need to know that they sat down to drink? And then it says, V'yoir Shushan Navocha, that the city of Shushan was astounded, was perplexed. Now take a look at chapter 4, which states that Mordechai knew everything that had taken place. And he went forth in the city and he screamed this loud and bitter wail. Now in the second verse, he came up to the front entrance, the gate, the courtyard of the king. Because one could not go actually be at the gate when he was dressed up in sackcloth. He wasn't dressed properly. He went as far as he could go. Beyond that point, he couldn't go because he wasn't dressed properly. Now, in Gimel, it seems to interrupt the dialogue. U'b'chol Medina, Medina. Now it tells you what happened in all of the provinces. The place where the decree of the king had arrived. Evel Gadol Yehudim. There was great mourning for the Yehudim. Vitzamu b'chi, u'mispeit, fasting, crying, eulogizing. Sakva eifa, yutzal harab. So everybody was caught up in this mood, wearing sackcloth and ashes. Then it goes back to the story of Mordechai, that the mistresses of Esther, her assistants, came before him, told her about Mordechai, and she was very upset, and she sent garments for him to get dressed. What's going on over here? It seems like you have a huge contrast between what's going on in Shushan and what's going on in the rest of the provinces. In the rest of the provinces, they're already wearing sackcloth and they're fasting and involved in tshuva and so forth. What's going on? Rashi anu Mordechai yada. Bala chalom amarlo. Sheskimu hal yonim lakach. The master of a dream had told him that the powers, the heavenly powers, so to speak, had agreed to this. Means to say that he had some type of a prophetic insight, perhaps in a dream, whatever the case, that there was a haskama from heaven, an agreement from heaven to the earthly decree. Because they had bowed down to an idol in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. And because they had enjoyed themselves at the Sa'uda, at the meal of Achashverosh. That would explain that Mordechai knew Kol Asher Nasa, not just the specific decree, because that apparently everybody knew. It says the entire city was Navocha, was perplexed. In contradistinction to that, you see the Megillah is drawing a distinction between the general reaction in Shushan, as opposed to the reaction of Mordechai. But really, we see from all the verses we've read, there are three different reactions to the decree. There's the reaction of Shushan, there's the reaction of Mordechai, then there's the reaction of the provinces, the distant provinces, when they received the decree. It's interesting then, we can at least understand from a structural standpoint what's happening over here. Certain verses seem to be out of place, but it's not the case. In Tezvav, in 15, it tells you that the messengers went forth and the word got out to deliver the decree. Then it tells you their various reactions to that phenomenon, starting with the reaction of HaMelech Haman. They sat down to drink. Then the city of... Well, first it describes the reaction of the perpetrators. That you see something from this, from the fact that their immediate reaction was Yashvu Lishtos, that they sat down to drink. What does that show you? That shows you that there was no real ideological basis. All the anti-Semites tried to justify what they do, to try and make it seem that they're doing something beneficial, that there's some kind of a real evil associated with the Jews, and that they're doing something for the betterment of mankind. That's what all the anti-Semites believe. Hitler, Yimach Shmo, and the rest of them. However, you can distinguish genuine idealism from the phony kind, which is base instinctualism, hatred of the lowest kind, which is masquerading as such. And essentially, people really can't hide their true emotions. It's impossible. If something is being done out of a certain necessity, for example, if you're studying the Torah when the Jews fought their enemies or fought Amalek, or even after the Kriyas Yamsuf and they sang Shira, that's something else. The entire Shira is really a glorification of God, but it doesn't indicate that they sat down to drink. Now, to the contrary, there's the famous Chazal that said that the angels wanted to sing Shira and God rebuked them. There's an element of rebuke. The works of my hands are drowning in the sea. But where people break out into this instinctual celebration of drinking wine, then it's clear what the true motivation is. And the same thing is true with all of the anti-Semites, the Nazis and so on and so forth. Essentially, it's nothing but the basest level of instinctualism seeking to masquerade itself as something noble or ideological or something having some kind of a purpose for the betterment of mankind. That's all phony. It stems from their own egotism, their own corruption, and their own desire for power, for aggression, and to be able to gratify all of their sadistic drives. Rishus, evil. There's a real contrast here in terms of the Ir Shushan, as opposed to Mordechai. Mordechai was part of Shushan. And then you have the outlying provinces. They seem to have the same reaction as Mordechai. There is a significant difference between the Jews of Shushan and the Jews of the outlying provinces. Mordechai's reaction was based not merely on the fact that there's a physical danger, but Rashi is pointing out that he realized, he was able to see that there was an element of punishment, that there was a divine judgment. That's what Rashi is saying. That the Elyonim, the higher powers, so to speak, it's a reference to God, had given their consent. Because he was able to see that the Jews were not blameless. So Rashi mentions two things. Apparently the fact that they had given in to idolatry in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, which wasn't too much behind this, before this. And they had enjoyed themselves. They had partaken of the party of Nebuchadnezzar. Now let's try to understand what is so terrible about that. He gave a party to establish his rule, and the Jews apparently attended. Why would that be so bad? Rashi uses the word nene. It's one thing sometimes you have to go somewhere to make an appearance out of respect for the government. You can have that. And you may be invited to a certain event. It could be a banquet and so on and so forth. But if you have no choice to go, you can go there to show your face and to be respectful. But it's a different thing when you're nana. When you're nana means you partake. And once you partake, so then it's not just partaking of the food. You're partaking of the whole hedonistic experience, the materialism, the whole philosophy. That's the problem of assimilation. That's the problem that we face in America. It's very, very difficult to find that middle ground. Either you separate yourself, which is what many Orthodox people do, some kind of an insulation. Perhaps it's a higher level to be able to partake of those things that are beneficial from the culture, but not be affected or corrupted by the false philosophy. That's much more difficult, though. Apparently, the Jews, on a significant level, were affected by the fact that they partook of the Sa'uda, that they indulged themselves. And when you indulge, so then it changes your whole attitude, your whole value system. You really look up to this. That's Avodah Zarah. That's the tantamount to bowing down to the idol. You have to realize the significance of this kind of thing. It becomes idolatry in a different way, because hedonism, materialism, this becomes the ultimate good, the ultimate reality. So that's another form of idolatry. That's what Mordechai saw. And that was part of the tragedy. That's part of the reaction. And he recognizes that it's because of those factors, it's that much more dangerous and much more complicated. But what about the people of the city? They were confused. That fits in perfectly with this. To the extent that the Jews have always assimilated and become part of the culture and identified with the culture, to that extent they were unable to take seriously any type of turns against them. This happened to the Jews in Nazi Germany. They always kept rationalizing when Hitler was coming to power, when he came to power. They never believed it would be possible that he actually would carry out what he threatened, that it could ever get to that level, because of the fact that they identified they're part of Germany. And they had made so many contributions to Germany. Because of that, they were unprepared. Perhaps confused. Confused is a good term. But to be able to see through it and to recognize it for what it is at the very outset, only Mordechai. Mordechai had the clearest picture of what the reality was on all levels, on the physical level and on the metaphysical level. The outlying provinces, their reaction was very, very realistic. To the extent that they had not become part of Shushan, had not identified with the culture, they did not lose their realistic attitude. The fear that Jews are always an endangered species. Jews can never afford to get too comfortable. The situation can always turn against the Jew. The Jew is the universal target for all of the base individuals. True throughout history, it's true today. Any regime that promotes itself as being dominant to superior and is trying to impose its will through brutal force, they're always going to tap the Jews as the victim. They always hate the Jew. It's always got to be the case. Now, of course, Jews in America have had a great time. The best possible situation you could want. There's no better place for a Jew to be than in America, including Israel. And the question arises, can we now put all anti-Semitic fears behind us? Is it over? It's a thing of the past as far as America is concerned. Is America the ultimate safe haven? And can we be complacent about anti-Semitism in America? The people in the outlying provinces were very realistic about it, about the situation. As far as the Jews in America today, it's very difficult to say whether it can happen here, due to the fact that the nature of the country, the institutions are such. It's not to say that people don't have emotions. There are Nazi skinhead groups out there. On the emotional level, you can find in different parts of the country people that have tremendous animosity, hatred, Nazi groups that would be very happy to exterminate the Jews. So as far as that is concerned, that exists in America. The only question is, are the defenses that have been established by the American system, the American government, to utterly eradicate any type of bigotry against any kind of people? And the fact that this country, one of the benefits for the Jews is that it's a melting pot. Generally speaking, anti-Semitism is threatening when you have one particular, like the French, a group of people, a country that's made up of a people with a very strong sense of unity in terms of identification. You really don't have that in America. You have different kinds. You have black Americans, you have Chicano, you have Irish, you have Italian. Due to the fact that you have many, many different types of groups, it's a healthy thing because you don't have that sense of pride, that group pride. It doesn't even become a problem. You see, due to the tremendous freedom, even now the country's about to go to war, there's a tremendous amount of anti-war, unpatriotic kind of sentiment. So that's not a good thing, but the fact of the matter is that since you have so much dissent in this country, and the concept of dissent is so respected, and since the idea of any type of discrimination is looked down upon, that's one of the main issues, racial discrimination. If anybody of any importance says any kind of comment, even indirectly, it could go to extremes that mildly speaking could be a little bit insensitive to blacks or to Jews, this person immediately is under a storm of protest. So therefore, the question is, are the defenses that have been built up in this country, in the institutions of this country, powerful enough so that this could never, even though the emotion is there, but it's so repressed, it's so under control, that the emotion of anti-Semitism could never break out and lead to the type of tragedies we've known in the past? That if that would happen, that would mean that America would disintegrate. It wouldn't be the same America anymore. That's the argument that I've made. My response to the question of can it happen here? When I say can it happen here, America as presently constituted, not if there was a coup d'etat, if there was an overthrow of the government and a revolution by some group and they took power and then they persecuted the Jews, that wouldn't be America as we know it. That's a different issue. That also is very hard to imagine due to the fact that the stability of this democracy is very powerful. What I'm saying is the possibility of the government itself becoming anti-Semitic and embarking on a new policy of persecution to me seems impossible. Any individual today, on any significant level, to run for any office, if he has, he expresses any kind of bigoted views, he doesn't have a chance, virtually anyways. Maybe in some district somewhere he can get elected as the local representative, but anything beyond that, to become a senator, to become a national figure, I'm not aware of any national figure in a position of authority in this country that has any taint of racism. Trent Lott was recently forced basically out of a position of majority leader because he had complimented Strom Thurmond something about the who was a segregationist at one time. And that too, anybody who was a segregationist had to change, had to give all of that up, and now become in favor of equal rights for everyone. So by merely saying something which was the wrong thing to say, made some kind of a joke which gave the impression that had the South won the Civil War, things would have been better, something like that, which was a stupid thing to say and all of that. But in spite of the fact that for all these years, he wasn't a segregationist, he wasn't a bigot, still in all, the uproar was so tremendous that he lost the position of being majority leader. This indicates that as presently constituted, it's hard to imagine how a person on any kind of a program of anti-Semitism or any kind of a program of bigotry would get anywhere in this country. You have to be elected. It's interesting to note that in recent memory, the last 50, 60 years, the group that exhibited the greatest degree of anti-Semitism, it seems to me, were the black extremists, a lot of the black extremist groups like the Black Panthers and such. They were appealing to a certain element among people, their people, to exploit the latent envy, jealousy, hatred, the idea that the reason why we haven't gotten anywhere in this world is because we're being oppressed. There's a plot, the Jews. Anyone who wants to attract base individuals on the lowest level will always target the Jews. That's the same thing that the Islamics said. The reason why we're being held back, why we're oppressed, why we can't make any progress is because of a worldwide plot. It's always the Jews. The Jews are the universal enemy. I would say I can't answer the question. My sense is that American democracy is very strong. And on that level, it's hard to imagine how it would happen. However, I say that's irrelevant. We always have to be on guard, vigilant. The Jew, by definition, must be vigilant. And, you know, you can speculate, you can give theories, but you can't live on the basis of theories. You've got to live with a very strong reality principle. And you can't fall into the mistake that the Jews of Germany made, the Jews of Europe in general, of underestimating the power, the potential of anti-Semitism, which is the mistake that was made, thereby preventing them from getting out while they still could, and overestimating the other forces, overestimating the friendly forces that are out there, because in that sense as well, the Jews were terribly, terribly dismayed. They were let down by the whole world, free world, the United States, England, and so forth included. The reaction of Mordechai seems very, very similar to the reaction of the people in the outlying provinces. It seems there's only one difference. They reacted with full awareness of the seriousness, sense of doom. They were not engaged in any kind of denial. So you have the fasting, you have the crying, the hesped, the sackcloth, which seems that they were involved in praying to God and doing tshuva and so forth. The only thing that's different in the reaction of Mordechai is it has to do with the Za'aka Gedola. Vayizak Za'ak, he went into the middle of the city and screamed a loud and bitter wail. Which means to say that he wasn't just resigned to the situation and limited only to the ability to cry and to do tshuva, to that element, which is of course extremely important, but there's another fundamental aspect in terms of the reaction. Of course, we know that you can't rely on a miracle, and ain't some chalaneis. You can't rely on a miracle, and you have to do everything in your power to bring about a natural change. You have to operate within the given order. So he went forth into the middle of the city. What was the purpose of that? Zaka gedola umara. What was the purpose of that? On the surface, it doesn't seem to accomplish anything by going out and screaming aloud and bitter wail. The point is being made that there was navalcha, there was confusion in the city. The city of Shushan was confused. And it was essential to clarify the situation. So Mordechai, of course, his main objective was to get the attention of Esther. She was the one who had the ability to act, to intervene. But it wouldn't be sufficient just to get Esther alone. He had to make it clear to the entire people that this was very, very serious. You can't be in any kind of denial about this. And don't overestimate your situation. This reinforces the idea that the people in Shushan have partaken of assimilation. And once you partake of assimilation, your whole attitude towards the possibility of danger changes. And therefore, you're confused. And Mordechai was not confused. He was not assimilated. He refused to bow down to Haman. So he didn't hold back whatsoever. He tore his garments out of a recognition that this was a serious situation, that they were on the brink of destruction. And in that situation, the tearing of the garments, the putting on the sackcloth, is to remove any possibility of complacency, any possibility of denial. And he went forth in the middle of the city and screamed a loud and bitter wail. Not that that's going to change the decree, but it's going to make it very, very clear what the nature of the situation is. You can't go about life as usual, business as usual. In conjunction with this, a book I'm reading now about the failure of the Jews, the failure of America to come to the aid sufficiently of the Jews during the Holocaust. I'm going to paraphrase. The Polish underground, the Jews in Poland who were in the underground, who were trying to resist, to fight off the Nazis, they were clearing the ghettos and so forth. So a major objective was to get the message out to the Jews in the free world, especially the Jews in America, the Jews in England. So it describes how they sent this individual as a messenger to plead the case, to report to them about all the deportations, all the destructions and what they were planning, and to plead for to make the case to all of the Jews in America, but through the Jewish organizations, the American Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee, and so on, all the various Jewish groups, that once they hear what's going on, they'll make a loud scream of a loud and bitter wail. So another one of the members of the Jewish underground who had experience, who knew the realities of Jewish life, Jewish organizational life, said something, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't have the exact quote. He says, yeah, go ahead. You'll convene these groups together at about 10 o'clock in the morning, and you'll start presenting your story, detailing all the terrible, terrible tragedies. A couple of hours will go by, and the people will be listening with rapt attention. And then they'll interrupt you. And they'll say, hold it, let's pause. We have to go to lunch now. To go to lunch. And then they'll go to lunch. And then they'll finish lunch. They'll come back and you know the rest of the story. Then they'll go home at night. And basically life will go on as usual. That became the thing, that the Jews will listen to your story, but they can't interrupt the basic routine. And they'll go on with life as usual. Unfortunately, that type of an idea, that type of thing is exactly what occurred. It didn't manage to produce this reaction that the Jews as a united group went out into the middle of the city in loud and bitter wail and screaming and to tear down heaven and earth to stop what was going on. 12,000 people a day were being killed in Auschwitz. It didn't receive that kind of an emotional reaction. No, they heard, they listened, they made some efforts, of course they went through the motions, but they didn't interrupt their daily life. They didn't miss a meal. That's what he was trying to convey. They didn't stop eating, they didn't stop going to parties, they didn't stop business as usual. That's the point that he was trying to make. That's what Mordechai did not fall into that trap. To the contrary, you can't go on with daily life. Everything stops. A person like him, a great Talmud Chacham, and so on and so forth, such a great distinguished person, goes around with sackcloth and ashes screaming like a crazy raving maniac. That's what you have to do. The critique of the American Jewish community is not that they just ignored it and didn't do anything. They did. They made efforts. But the point of that story, that they'll go on with lunch, as usual, is to indicate a certain attitude. There are different attitudes you have towards problems. There are certain problems that you treat in a business-like kind of way. A person is a doctor, a serious professional, you know. But the doctor doesn't have to work 24 hours a day. So then there, you have to recognize there are certain situations that you go about in the natural way. You do your job. You're doing your job. No one's saying they weren't doing the job. But you have to recognize that this is an unprecedented kind of a calamity that you can't treat. You can't just go about this in the ordinary way. You've got to be like Mordechai. We have a precedent for that, like Mordechai. And you've got to go out there and shake on the doors of the government, the leaders, and so on and so forth until you reach them. You can't just write a letter, request a meeting, state your case. That's normal channels. You can't use normal channels. And all this depends upon your degree of perfection. If you're essentially, you're concerned, you want to help, and so on and so forth, but it's happening to somebody else, I'm doing the best I can, ordinary kind of situation, then that's what's going to happen. If your reaction is, this is my family, it's happening to my family, how would you act then? Your family has been taken hostage, and this is what can happen. I have to do everything I could possibly do. I can't sleep, I can't rest, this is my life. That's what you have to do in this kind of situation, because your whole family's being wiped out. With regard to the Megillah in Perek Beis, the second chapter, it talks about what Ahasuerus did after he realized the mistake that he had made. As we mentioned, the killing of Vashti has to be regarded as a mistake. And we said it fits into our whole concept of the downfall of the wicked. This was a downfall, so to speak. When I say downfall, it doesn't necessarily mean that he was destroyed, but it's a failure and it's a setback, and we can learn from it as to the mechanism of the wicked person, the person who lives in accordance with his emotional reality. This is the essence of chapter 2, that after things quieted down, when the anger of the king dissipated, and as we said, the mistake of the Rasha is that he makes decisions in a state of anger. And of course, in that state, he can only do things that are destructive. Destructive to others and destructive to himself. Then it says, Zachar as Vashti, v'yesa sherasasa. He remembered Vashti and what she had done. V'yesa shen nigzar aleha. And that which had been decreed against her, which means death. It's interesting, the pasuk doesn't say what his judgment was. It just says he remembered. He remembered Vashti, he remembered what she had done, and the decree. It's a strange kind of a pasuk, because it's what does that mean, he remembered? But what was the decision? What was the outcome of remembering? The pasuk mentions three things that he remembered. First, he remembered Vashti. That's very significant. Obviously, he didn't forget her. But what is the attitude that you have towards a person? That's in a state of flux. When somebody asks you, how do you feel about a certain person? What's your feeling about a certain person? So if essentially you're emotionally neutral and you think about it, you'll put thought into it. It's not something that you can always answer off the top of your head. It's not that simple. I could ask you about various people, and what's your attitude towards them, or how do you feel about them? You may want time to think. It's not that simple. And after thinking about it, you can come up with a certain type of an answer, because, you know, you have to consider the various factors and form a balanced picture. Of course, with other people, you know, you may be able to answer much quicker. If we're talking about people that are close to you, your spouse or your children or a good friend, so you may answer immediately, I like that person very much. But you see, even a person that you like very much, you realize that how you feel about that person is not a constant phenomenon. It's pretty much in a state of flux, especially with people that are close to you. Because it is affected by the day-to-day. So that if someone that's close to you disappoints you, makes you angry, so you become angry at that person. Of course, you always have to differentiate between two things. Between the underlying attitude of the soul towards that person and the current emotional attitude towards that person. That is very, very significant. And we know this very well, because you could be extremely angry at someone. And at the same time, this could be someone that you love very much. As, for example, with regard to a child. Your child can do something that makes you extremely angry, and you'll even say, I want to strangle him or her. That's your feeling right now. That's how you feel. That's how angry you are right now. But is that the true attitude of your soul towards that person? That's something which is totally different. And when you calm down, that'll come back into the focus. And you'll say, there's no contradiction. I love this person. Deep down, I really love this person. I value this person. I treasure this person. Well, if that's the case, then how do you feel so angry that you want to kill that person? Isn't there a contradiction that you want to kill someone that you love? My understanding of this, it sounds strange on the surface, because you're saying you love this person, but because you love this person, the things that they do to upset you cause a tremendous reaction and will elicit even greater hatred than it would from somebody else that you didn't love so much. But the question I'm asking is, are we saying that you love and hate at the same time? Well, just before we go any further, Freud pointed out that there's really no such thing as pure love. Every relationship contains the element of ambivalence. That is to say that there's love and hate in every relationship. So this fantasy of absolute love, pure love, that people go for is a fantasy. That's all it is. That's why it leads to a lot of disappointment. And a lot of these tremendous romances and love affairs very often wind up in divorce and, to the contrary, tremendous anger and hatred. His idea, Freud's idea, was that of all the human relationships, the one that is most devoid of the element of ambivalence, that is to say, the one that is most ideally a relationship of pure love with the least amount of the ambivalence. Interestingly enough, he maintained that it was the the mother-son relationship. The love of a mother for a son, according to Freud, was the least ambivalent. And therefore, from the emotional standpoint, the most satisfying relationship in terms of the emotional aspect of love. As far as this case is concerned, I would use an analogy that people make a mistake in life in general in associating an emotion with a state of the soul. That is to say, most people are in pursuit of happiness. Everybody's in pursuit of happiness. It's not most people, it's everybody, because there's no other way that a person can function. It's something which is ingrained into our nature. The mistake that people make is that they identify happiness with a certain type of a feeling, that is to say, with pleasure. So they imagine that if they can put themselves in a situation where they can simply experience pleasure,
and avoid the experience of pain, so then they will be happy. However, happiness and pleasure are not necessarily synonymous, nor are pain and unhappiness also either synonymous. That is to say that a person can be experiencing pleasure and still be unhappy. That's a very obvious fact. That many people who are in general unhappy doesn't mean that they are unhappy because they're not experiencing any pleasure. Obviously, to the extent that a person is less happy, to that extent they will be less capable of experiencing pleasure. But let's say they're eating good food. Let's say they're wealthy and they're eating good food and they live in a beautiful house and they have sexual gratification, whatever you want to say, whatever you want to throw in. They go to the movies, they go to entertainment. So these people can experience a great deal of pleasure, but after all said and done, are they happy? They themselves will admit that they're not happy. At the same time, a person can be experiencing pain and can be happy. Not to say that the experience of pain, of course, it's going to impact. There's going to be an impact. It's going to diminish. But people that are struggling, for example, for a goal, working very hard, deprived of certain physical pleasures, nevertheless can say that inwardly they feel very happy because they believe in what they're doing. They're fighting for a cause. And the realization that what they're doing is having an effect upon the cause makes them very happy. But let me give you a simpler explanation. A person can be going through some type of treatment for a serious disease, which would kill him if it weren't treated. And this treatment can be very physically painful. The person for months has to experience different pains and side effects of the medications and so on and so forth. But the person knows that after going through this 6 months or 8 months, whatever it is, the disease is going to be cured and their life is going to be saved. So when you visit that person in the hospital, say, and you ask them how they're feeling, they could tell you they're feeling a lot of pain. But then if you ask a different question, are you happy or unhappy, they could say they're extremely happy. Because that's a different issue. When they contemplate that, the phenomenon that they knew that they had a serious disease and a cure was found, and when you look at the entire situation, reflecting on the situation, whether it's a good situation or a bad situation, it's a good situation, and the fact that it's good makes them happy. The idea that they have to go through pain is something completely different. That's a different question. Yes, it's painful, but the fact that I'm experiencing pain doesn't necessarily take away from the fact that I'm happy about the situation. Nor does the fact that I'm experiencing pleasure have an impact necessarily on the fact that I'm happy. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be happy. An extreme case, a person who is going to be executed in America has his choice of the last meal. And he could choose the most delicious foods that he enjoys the most. And while he's eating it, he'll be experiencing the pleasure of eating. But if you ask him whether he's happy or not, I think it's going to be a completely different response. The mistake that Ahasuerus made was that he associated his momentary emotional reaction for the reality. That is one of the biggest mistakes that people make. It's an interesting insight in terms of relationships. It's good advice for people that are looking, you know, for shidduchim to get married and things of the sort. This mistake is made all the time. The emotion that this person evokes in me for the moment, that is not necessarily a barometer of what the attitude of the soul would be to the person. That's based upon different considerations. You have to evaluate the person as a whole. You got to pull yourself away. Of course, the emotional effect is one of the things you're going to consider, obviously. That's one of the factors. But That is not the same thing. That's why Zachar as Vashti means that he looked at Vashti from the standpoint of distance, from the standpoint of perspective, and was able to formulate his overall attitude towards her. He remembered Vashti, and that is the person. He remembered the person, and he remembered that she was a person who was worthy of his love. He loved her. That was his big mistake, that he mistook his anger and his frustration because she refused to come, whatever the case may be. She evoked a certain emotional state within him, and it caused him to forget completely his underlying attitude towards her. And he mistook that feeling for what she was. And on the basis of that, he then proceeded to deal with her as though she was someone who he did not love. And of course, it's only because of that he agreed to this very, very exaggerated, very, very harsh, severe, and unnecessary punishment. That's why I say it was a tremendous blunder. The way of the wicked has to lead to failure. And that's what the pasuk is saying. Kesho chamas ha-melech, when the anger died down, and it takes a long time for the anger of the wicked to die down, because they nurture their anger, they can't let go of it. Then Zachar as Vashti, then he remembered, and he had to face up to it. And when he remembered the real Vashti, the person, and the person was someone that he loved. Then he remembered what she did, and what she did was not that terrible when you looked at it from the correct perspective, not from the perspective of anger. Then the Eishah Nigzar Lah, and what was decreed upon her, and that, looking at it from that perspective, that someone that he really loved and valued, who happened to disagree, when in retrospect, he may have looked at it the way we looked at it. That is, he could have seen the other side, that he was asking for something unreasonable, that maybe it wasn't an affront to him, but that it was an impinging on her dignity. And then what was done to her? That's what the pasuk is telling you. And there's no question that he was in a state of deep regret. This type of phenomenon is a very important lesson, because this affects us on the level of virtually every relationship that we could possibly be in. That is, we cannot differentiate between a certain specific emotional reaction which another individual may evoke in us and the underlying attitude that we would have, we ought to have, if we gave ourselves a chance to truly know the other person. As I said, this affects people in dating, in searching for the appropriate mate, and you see that with an over 50% divorce rate, that obviously mistakes are being made. It works both ways, because if the person evokes a very pleasant, a very positive reaction on the emotional level, then the automatic assumption is that this person is really good, because I feel love. If I feel love about this person is good. If I feel anger and hatred for this person is bad. That's the false association that people make. And the same is true even with regard to friendships. The extent to which people make their judgments based not upon an attempt to really get to know the other person, but rather based upon the emotion that this person evokes in me, whether positive or negative, is something that permeates all relationships, friendships as well. Then it tells us what was done in response. It expresses it in a very interesting way. Vayomru narei hamelech mishorsav. And the youths, the servants, the youthful servants of the king said, let there be a search for young virgin girls who are good looking. So the idea to organize this beauty contest, this search for the most beautiful girl, was not something that came to him from the same type of advisors who had given him the original advice to kill Vashti. That's something which is interesting, because when it came to dealing with Vashti, he consulted his most senior advisors. They were referred to as the Shiva Sare Parasamadai, the rulers, governors, those who saw the face of the king, those who were closest to him, Ayoshim Rishonim Amalchus. They were the at the highest level. They're the ones who were sought out for that advice. Yet on this issue, it's the Na'arim, like the kids, the servants, so to speak, interns, I guess, would be the term we would use today. What's going on here? It seems to me that he did not turn to his advisors. It's inevitable that there had to be some kind of a rupture, some kind of an anger against these advisors, because he had listened to their advice. Well, that's obviously his fault. He shouldn't have listened to their advice. But in a situation like this, this is not going to help you. When you're dealing with someone like Ahasuerus, then you can't use any kind of justification that you agreed with us, that you were very angry with her, and you demanded immediate action. All of this will be of no avail. A person should be very careful about that. When you're asked to give your advice to a certain type of an individual, bear in mind that even if that person approves of the advice, if it turns out to be something which is significantly bad, then most likely, with regard to most people, unless you're dealing with someone who's absolutely just and honest, they're going to blame you for the advice. You should have known that I was in a bad condition and I wasn't in the best state of mind, and in that state of mind, you should not have told me that. So he clearly does not turn to them. So it's interesting that this type of advice comes from the interns. I'm using that term now to refer to these Na'arei HaMelech, the youthful ones. We have to raise the question, though, objectively speaking, was it a good idea?
To kill Vashti?
Question is, what do we learn from this? From the fact that they stepped forward and they gave this kind of advice and the king followed them. Let's ask ourselves the question. Insofar as his particular makeup was concerned, his objectives, was it good advice? In my opinion, you do see something about the functioning, the methodology of the instinctual individual. We would call that person the Rasha, the wicked person. The wicked person meaning someone who's not living in accordance with the truth, who's pursuing a different objective. Essentially, his life is based on the principle of the ultimate good of instinctual gratification. So you see one thing. He remembered, it doesn't go further than that. He remembered Vashti and what had been done and what she had done and what had been decreed. It doesn't go any further. There's no attempt to correct the self. The focus of the instinctual individual, or the focus of the Rasha, is never on the self. It's always on the external situation. That is to say that the person's basic belief is that whatever he's pursuing, the happiness that he's pursuing, can only come about through obtaining something in the external situation. That's the fundamental idea of the Rasha. You see the difference between this approach, of course, and the philosophy of Yahadus. And this is exhibited in the Megillah itself. Later on, you'll see that. That is to say that the main conquest, the main source of all of the pains that a person experiences, and the main source of whatever happiness or pleasure a person can experience in this world, has to do with what's going on internally. That true happiness stems from a certain state of the soul, from the internal condition. And therefore, when a person experiences a pain, a loss, a failure, or a downfall, the instinct is to deny it, to just get right, as they say, Yeah, if a person is a car accident, get right back in the car and drive. Get right back on the horse. If you fell off a horse, get right back on the horse and ride away. Now, I would agree with that. But that doesn't apply in a situation like this. In a situation where a person knows how to ride a bike, let's say, and even if you know how to ride a bike very well, you could always get into some kind of an accident. You can go over a banana peel, whatever, or somebody makes a quick turn, so you fall off. So then there's momentarily your confidence is shaken. And that could develop into a certain kind of a problem. Because the emotions are acting irrationally. That's always the case. If a person is in a close call with an airplane, they might develop a certain fear, which they never had before, which is irrational. Because then the emotions are operating in an irrational kind of a way. Therefore, it's beneficial for the person in that situation not to give in to the emotion, a fear. And if possible, the good advice would be get right back on the bike, get right back in the car, get right back in the airplane. Obviously, I'm not talking when the person's still in a state of shock. We don't mean that. But don't wait. Don't postpone. Because the longer you do that, the more time you're giving for these emotions to go through a certain type of a process, and it could produce a phobia. That's the way the emotions work when they're in this type of an irrational tailspin. That's why in all these situations that we're talking about, if a person has a mishap, it could be you get up in front of a group and you give a class or you give a speech somewhere and you just blow the whole thing, whatever. Or somebody asked you a question and caught you completely off guard, and it was a very, very unpleasant kind of an experience. Assuming that it's not indicative of the fact that you really shouldn't be up there in the first place, that's a different kind of a question. But these types of setbacks can happen to anyone, will happen to anyone from time to time, especially when you're breaking in. And the people that succeed are the ones that don't give in to the emotion. The emotion tells you, let me just stay away from this. They continue. That doesn't mean to say that at the same time that they continue, they should be studying, reviewing, and finding out what went wrong. Perhaps they didn't prepare sufficiently enough. Perhaps they did make a mistake. That's a separate process. But the idea of get right back in there makes sense. This is not the case over here. It's not a situation where you say, just forget about it. Don't worry about it. We'll straighten it out. That's exactly what the Na'arim said. That's why this is the advice of Na'arim. That's the way young people look at the world. They have this feeling that they can do anything and they can get away with anything. And big deal. When you're young, you feel immortal. So therefore, they do reckless things. They take drugs. They are irresponsible, even in business. Because they have this feeling, what difference? We'll start another business. One fail, we'll do another thing. You have this feeling of the ability to just do whatever you want to do, and that you don't have to face the consequences of your actions. That's the situation that emerges over here. That Ahasuerus realized the consequences. He had made a mistake, and when you make mistakes, especially serious ones, there are consequences, and you pay the consequences. That's what would have happened if he was surrounded by good advisors that truly had his interests at heart, but that wasn't the case. Right at that moment, when from an emotional standpoint, he might have begun to question what went wrong over here, to learn something from it, and to make some adjustments, to make some changes, the Na'arim come right into the picture, and they really base themselves. They clue into that underlying emotion. There's nothing to be upset about. Forget about it. You'll see. It was the best thing that could have happened. Truth of the matter is, it wasn't a mistake, it wasn't the wrong thing, it was the best thing that could have happened. There are no consequences, because as a result of this, we're going to make this tremendous pageant. Now, I think that might explain the idea behind it, and the reason why the Megillah records it, is that he was in a situation where he was depressed, and he needed not just another woman. My question was that this is a strange way to search for a queen. We've never heard of anything like this. It's not the way royal matches are arranged. And from a purely rational standpoint, it's true he may be searching for the most beautiful girl and all of that, but there are other ways that you can go about it. You could have some key advisors, and it's not they know who to ask in every place. Where do you find the beautiful girls and all of that? And besides beauty, you're looking for some other qualities, certain types of personalities and so forth. That's the way a person like Ahasuerus would have gone about it. I don't think that had he been a bachelor, let's assume that he hadn't been married to Vashti, and we don't know how he chose Vashti. I don't think that they had this kind of pageant before. So the decision to do this was not based upon the fact that he didn't have a wife and he needed a wife and that this is the way to go about it. The decision to do this was to enable him to escape from the consequences of his own behavior and to retain a certain type of a fantasy outlook on life, which shields a person, which shields a person from ever having to accept the fact that he's made mistakes, that he's fallible, that his irrational way of acting leads to failure. To the contrary, people that live this way always have to believe that even though it was a failure, it wasn't a failure because somebody, God, was looking out for me, and the truth is it was destined to be that way because it's going to lead to something even greater. That's how people look at these things. Instead of doing a sober analysis of themselves. That's why I think that the plan, so to speak, is saying that this is a tremendous opportunity. We're going to do something that was never done before. You're going to have a chance to get the best possible woman. That'll be much, much better than Vashti. See, if you're just looking rationally for another woman, so then can she really take the place of Vashti? You'll always be comparing. Remember, Zachar is Vashti. He remembered Vashti. So the danger was there that whoever you pick now, he's going to have some kind of a balance. He's going to compare it to Vashti. It's not going to work. But this puts it in a completely different plane. Because now you're going to get the most beautiful woman in the whole kingdom, in Paras and Madai. So that's going to be the ultimate fantasy. This is your fantasy woman, and when you get the fantasy, so then you'll stop thinking about Vashti. That, I believe, is why the Megillah devotes so much space to this. There's a whole plan over here. And let's go through the psukim. The Yafkeid HaMelech Pekidim, the king should appoint designated people. B'chol Medinos Malchuso, in all of the provinces of his kingship, which was a very vast empire. V'yikbetzu es kol nara basula, and they'll gather every young virgin. Notice that, it's every possible one. So, again, this fits in with what I'm saying, that you're going to get a woman who will satisfy that fantasy that you have. And so the point was not just to find a replacement for Vashti. That would have been easy. That would not have been an issue. But then he would have been unhappy because he had a certain attachment to Vashti. He loved her. And you see that after he killed her, after the anger wore off, Zachar is Vashti. So the memory of Vashti would always make him miserable. It wasn't just that he needed a woman. He needed to remove the attachment to Vashti. And the only thing that could achieve that was the satisfaction of this fantasy. So then it says that they'll gather every young virgin who was tovas mara, who was beautiful. It's the only quality that they mention. El shushan habira el beis hanashim. To shushan habira, to the place where they kept women. El yad hege, under the control of hege. Saris HaMelech, the minister of the king, Shomer HaNashim, who guarded the women, the Nasam Tamrukehen, and he would give their cosmetics. Now, Pasuk Dal, Vanara Shetita of the Enamelech, and the young girl, who will be good in the eyes of the king, Timlof Tachas Vashti. She will become the queen in the place of Vashti. And the matter was very good in the eyes of the king, and they did it. So you do see that it was a plan which was presented to him. It wasn't his own idea. And the plan did have intelligence to it, in the sense that it recognized what the problem was, that it wasn't an issue of finding a woman. But to the contrary, to go through the ordinary approach would not have worked. But rather to give him something which would clearly outshine what he already had had. And that's why you see he got excited about it. The matter was very good. He was happy about it. It restored his happiness, because instead his pride had been wounded. He had made a serious mistake, which had resulted in a serious loss. What they were telling him is, no, it's not a loss. You'll see. It's a great gain. Let's continue now. Pasuk Hey. Ish Yehudi Hayah B'Shushan Aviram. There was a Jew in Shushan Aviram. Ushmo Mordechai, Ben Yoreh, Ben Shimi, Ben Kish, Ish Yemini. His name was Mordechai. It traces lineage. And he was from Binyamin. There's a little bit of a discrepancy, because Yehudi could imply that he was from the tribe of Yehuda. That's the way Eben Ezra learns. However, Rashi learns that he was Ishimini, is from the tribe of Binyamin. So Ish Yehudi doesn't mean that he was from the tribe of Yehuda. Obviously, that would be a contradiction. But Rashi learns that he's called an Ish Yehudi because he was exiled with the Golas of Yehuda. And Rashi says that all those who were exiled with the kings of Yehuda are called Yehudim amongst the Gentiles, even if they were from a different sheva, a different tribe. Now, Pasuk Vav, the next Pasuk says, Asher Heglam Yerushalayim, who was exiled from Yerushalayim, with the exile that included Yechonya, the king of Yehuda, who had been exiled by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel.
There are different stages.
The question that I'm raising is, what's the significance of this? Now, we need to know Mordechai. The Megillah here is introducing us to the character of Mordechai. Obviously, he's a central figure in the story. And this is the point at which we are being introduced to him. Actually, we're really being introduced to Esther. But because of his close association with Esther, so we need to know about Mordechai as well. The relationship between Mordechai and Esther is a very important element of the story, of the Megillah story. Oh, we'll just put that, hold that in abeyance for a minute. Now, Zion, but he omen as Hadassah. And he raised Hadassah. The term omen is more than just raised. It implies nursing, which would indicate that from a very early age, he played the role of nursemaid. I guess you would call it like a surrogate parent. That's the extent to which he was involved in her upbringing. It's also interesting to note that she's being referred to as Hadassah as well. He Esther, Bas Dodo. Simple translation is that she was his cousin. The daughter of his uncle would make her his cousin. Ki Ema of Va'im. That's going back on why he raised her, because she didn't have a mother or a father. That is to say that she was an orphan. So that's why Mordechai assumed the responsibilities of raising her. Banar Yefas Tawar, the Telas Mara. And the girl was very good looking, very beautiful. Uvamosa via Viima, and when her father and mother died, Lakacha Mordechai Lo Lavas. Mordechai took her to him as a daughter. What's difficult is, it seems to me, is that there's a repetition. At the beginning of the pasuk, it says that he raised her. But he only has Hadassah. He raised her. Why? Because she didn't have a father or mother. Then it tells us that she was very beautiful. And then it tells us that when her father and mother died, Mordechai took her as a daughter. The fact that he took her as a daughter is simply repeating that he raised her. He nursed her, so to speak. I'm just going to speculate a bit here. Just throw out a possibility as to what's being said. And this would tie it in with the previous pasuk, which talks about the fact that he had been exiled, and which exile, and that it was by Nebuchadnezzar. So this was a very difficult time to live through the experience of exile. Now, it could be that it's talking about two distinct phases. That is, very often that this happened in Europe during the Holocaust. Families were separated, husbands, wives, children, and so forth. And afterwards, during the entire time of the Holocaust, many people didn't know what happened to their own families. Those in the camps didn't know what happened to those who were left behind, and vice versa. And afterwards, obviously the attempt was to find out and to unify those families that remained. And some families did survive, some cases they didn't, or one member didn't. So it could be that in the exile was a time of confusion. So she could have been separated from her parents. That's why at first it says, Ki ein lo av va'im. She didn't have a father and mother. So that was the first situation. It's telling you about the severity of the situation they went through. So in the first instance, he assumed the responsibility of, so to speak, nursing her, because she did not have a father and mother, which doesn't necessarily mean that they were dead. It means she didn't have access to them, because that was the nature of the exile. Then, that's one thing. That's one chesed that a person might do. In a time of stress, when you're being exiled, so people stick together. You take care of your own, especially your family. Then, however, when the dust settled and they resumed some type of a normal routine in the exile, it was discovered that her parents had died. So then, lekacha. Then Mordechai did not give her up for adoption or anything like that, but he actually adopted her officially as a daughter. The pasuk over here is describing the connection, the relationship that existed between Mordechai and Esther. I can't explain exactly the particular, on a particular way, why it's that important. It is important because that relationship is very significant in terms of what happens later on. Nobody was in a position to go to Esther. Esther achieved the position in which she could influence the king. She was the only one. When the disaster struck, the decree of annihilation, and Mordechai recognized the full meaning of it, and that something had to be done. Well, the only one that had any possibility of achieving anything was Esther. That's what he recognized. There was nothing else that could be done. You couldn't organize protests. and you couldn't deal with Haman, he understood the consequences, as we said. And he recognized that the only possibility, the only hope, would be with Esther. But bear in mind that Esther had resistance. That Esther's first reaction, let's fast forward right now. When Esther first heard about Mordechai, that he was carrying on and he was hysterical and he was distraught and he was in sackcloth, so she was extremely distressed by it. Of course, we understand why she was distressed. For all intents and purposes, Mordechai was like a father to her. So obviously, this is something terrible that's going on in order for him to behave this way. So she sent clothing for Mordechai to remove his sackcloth, and he refused to accept it. So then she sent Hasach, one of the ministers of the king, who was placed at her disposal. And she gave Hasach instructions to find out what was going on for Mordechai. So then Hasach went to Mordechai in Rehov Ha'ir. Actually, it's interesting that the Megillah is describing the specifics of the meeting, that the meeting was not held in any kind of an office, in any kind of a designated place, but rather in the Rehov Ha'ir, in the middle of the street. All of that is because Mordechai wanted to drive home the point that you can't treat this from the standpoint of any of the ordinary diplomatic niceties. So then Mordechai told him everything that had occurred. Apparently Hasach didn't know. And the apportioning of the money that Haman had promised for the king's treasure to destroy them, to destroy the Jews.
Actually, what?
Then the edict, the proclamation about what was to be done that was given out in Shushan to destroy them. He gave to him to show Esther and to tell her Ulatzavos Olah and to command her. So he informed Hasach of everything that had taken place, plus there was a message for Esther of what she should do. Lavo ala melech l'schanen lo, to go to the king, to plead with him. Ulevakesh mulfanav al ama, and to beg from him about her nation. So that's basically what he was able to do. She was the one who was in a position of power, and the plan was, the only thing that could possibly help was for her to intercede. So then Hasach came and told Esther the words of Mordechai. Now her first reaction, this is the message she sends back, that Kol Avdei HaMelech, all of the servants of the king, the Am, Medinos HaMelech, and all of the provinces, all the people from the different provinces, know that any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner courtyard, without being summoned, the rule is to be killed. There's no exception. Achas Dos Olahamas. Except if the king stretches forth the Sharvit Hazav, the golden scepter. And I have not been called to come before the king for 30 days. So the words of Mordechai were reported, excuse me, the words of Esther were reported back to Mordechai. So what was she saying, essentially? She had a logical argument. She was saying that it didn't make any sense because you have to deal with the reality, with the rules. The rules are that anybody that comes, even the queen, there's no exception to this rule. Whoever comes to the inner courtyard without being invited, without being summoned, runs the risk of being killed, unless the king changes his mind. It's possible. But you can't rely on that. And I haven't been called. So she hasn't been called, therefore she can't go. But she mentions that she hasn't been called for 30 days. And perhaps that might mean even further, not just that I haven't been summoned. All she should have said was that I haven't been summoned. Why does she have to mention that she hasn't been summoned for 30 days? that could be to indicate that she realizes that it's up to the king, that if he wants to spare someone because of how he feels about it, then he has the right to do so, obviously. He has the power to do so. But she has not been called for 30 days, which is an indication, perhaps, that from an emotional standpoint, he's not that connected to her at this point in time, which only increases the danger. That was her argument. Now, Mordechai, when he hears this, he responds to her in a very stinging kind of a way. And Mordechai said to reply to Esther, Al tadami benafsheich, do not imagine in your soul, limolet beis hamelach, that you'll be saved in the king's house, mikol Yehudim, from all the Jews. So essentially, he's implicitly accusing her of trying to separate herself from the decree, which in itself is strange. Esther was not saying that she would be saved. She wasn't saying that. What she was saying was practical, made sense, was a rational argument, that I can't go now. But the way to go about it was to arrange for a meeting, to get permission to come. She wasn't saying that she wouldn't plead with the king. She merely said that she's not going to do it the way he said she should do it, that she should just go unannounced. That wouldn't make any sense. But Mordechai gave stinging criticism. And he went so far as to sort of psychoanalyze her, accuse her of having a motive, which is very strange. Why didn't he just make his point? He disagreed. He held that in a situation like this, the very fact that you go through the ordinary diplomatic channels in and of itself weakens your case. That you've got to take the risk, you've got to put your life on the line, you've got to impress upon him that this thing is so significant to you that you can't wait, you can't ask for an appointment, and you've got to put your life on the line. Only that is going to get his attention. Which is true. That was the insight of Mordechai. But he doesn't say it that way. He's going further. He's going above and beyond that, and he's criticizing her. He's accusing her. There's an accusation over here. Don't imagine that you'll be saved. That is to say, he's saying that the reason why you're taking this position is because you don't have to feel so afraid. You think that you have a special position, and even if the matter fails, so then you'll be saved. That's a very audacious kind of thing, especially to say to a queen. But then he says, Ki emacharesh tacharishi b'eis azos, if you'll be silent at this time, revach v'atzola yamod l'yehudim mimokam acher, then salvation will spring forth for the Jews from a different place, the Yatu Beis Avich Tovedu, and you and your father's house will be lost. Umi Odea, and who knows, in La'es Kazos, if specifically, precisely for a time like this, he got Lamalchus, that you actually achieved this position. Mordechai did not engage in a rational argument with her. He didn't address her argument at all. He didn't say a word about that. He addressed her underlying attitude. And the underlying attitude, according to Mordechai, was lacking. She didn't grasp the full severity of the decree and what the situation called for and what she had to do. And she was thinking in purely personal terms. You see that because later on, when she's affected by his harsh words and she changes her position, and then she swings into action and she agrees to go after the fast of 3 days. And she says, Vanika Asher Avadati Avadati. And if I'm lost, I'm lost. She's prepared. She accepts the fact. She casts in her lot with the Jews. She's not trying to save herself through any other channel. Now, I'm not saying that she was consciously thinking these thoughts, and I'm not saying that Mordechai was accusing her of that. At face value, on the surface, this is a very harsh accusation. But what he means it on a different level. He's really telling her to really analyze yourself. The fact that you could look at it in the way you are would indicate that perhaps you do not fully identify with the Jews at this time. And it's possible that on a certain level, you're feeling that you have a certain edge, that you have a certain safety. And that's what he's trying to tell her. That you should look at it purely from the standpoint of the reality, not from your position. Don't attribute any significance whatsoever to the position that you're in. And to the contrary, the only significance at all is from the Ashkacha. Perhaps you should look at this purely from the standpoint of the objective situation. The Jews are in a situation of danger. They could be destroyed, and you're in a position to help. And if you can look at it from that standpoint, then you should look at it from the standpoint that that's the only reason. That's the only reason that you'd be in this position. Nothing else. And eliminate any other thought in terms of looking at this from a purely selfish point of view. Don't look at it from any selfish point of view. If you take the selfish point of view, then you and your whole father's house will be lost. That'll be the end. You're no longer going to be part of the Jewish people. That's basically, in general terms, what took place over here. And it had a tremendous effect upon Esther. Because you see that Vatomer Esther Lashvil Marchai, she commanded to respond, Leich Kenos Kol Yehudim. She swings, she's a different person after she hears this message. And now she's acting in accordance with the state of mind that Mordechai had indicated. Now it's possible, therefore, that it's very important for the Megillah to tell us about the close relationship that existed between Mordechai and Esther. Because if you didn't have this relationship, if Mordechai simply was a great Talmud Chacham and from an objective standpoint, and he heard about this and he had the same idea to go to the queen, then it seems to me that it would have been impossible for him to speak to her in this way. It would have been impossible for him to speak to her in this way because the situation wouldn't have allowed it. And it would have been virtually impossible for her to listen. She wouldn't have trusted him. She wouldn't have allowed herself to be spoken to that way. Because this is not the way you speak to a queen. It's not the way you speak to anybody. Unless you have a very special relationship with them, in general, when you're dealing with people, one Jew is dealing with a fellow Jew, and even if it's a friend, and you're discussing a strategy, what to do, and you're imploring the person, and this person gives you answers, generally, or excuses, you have to deal with those excuses. You have to show why they don't hold. Or you have to the contrary, her position, on a purely logical basis, would, practically speaking, seem to be the stronger position. And to be able to pierce through all of that, most people won't be spoken to this way. What are you psychoanalyzing me? What are you analyzing my motives? What are you telling me what I'm thinking? Answer my question. But to the contrary, this works perfectly. This type of communication presupposes a certain type of a closeness, a certain type of an insight, a certain type of a relationship where the person has tremendous respect and knows that when Mordechai is telling you this, it's not stemming from any emotion that he has, any agenda, but it's the reality. And you trust that person and you listen to that person. So it could be that it's only because of the special relationship that existed between Mordechai and Esther that the salvation was possible. And that's why the Megillah is pointing it out to us. That going back to the fact that they've been exiled, and they were exiled together, and the way he treated her, and he raised her, and then he took her in, and it wasn't just temporary, he took her in as a daughter, It means that there was a very special relationship there.